This week's show with Danielle Clough is sponsored by Stitchville USA and the Embroiderers Guild of America. Stitchville is located in Minnetonka, Minnesota, a short drive from Minneapolis, and specializes in cross-stitch, needlepoint, hardanger, punch needle, wool applique, counted canvas, framing, and finishing. The destination shop has more than 4,200 square feet with a large selection of patterns, fabric, fibers, canvas, and notions. For needlepointers, Stitchville has an extensive collection of painted canvases and counted canvas designs from all the top designers. Cross stitchers, just about everything you could want, they have or can get for you rather quickly. One thing I've enjoyed in the orders that I placed with Debbie at Stitchville is what I would describe as aggressive shipping. Every time I order, the shipment happens without delay. Well, she gets it out right away, and that's always, in this day of slow mail delivery, is always a plus. So you can count on that at Stitchville. And for more information, visit their website at stitchville.com. Our second sponsor is the Embroiderers Guild of America, and I want you all to mark your calendars for March 12, when registration opens for the 2022 National Seminar, Broadway Bound. The seminar will be held August 24 to 28 in New York City. Also, at egausa.org, check out the lineup of online classes. If you want to try something new, sign up for the Art of Petty Point on Silk Gauze with Natalia Frank. Another online course that you want to look at is Creating a Pattern for Embroidery from Digital Images with Julie Carmen. Many people want to create something they can stitch from an image, and this course will help you. Also, chapters should consider applying to participate in the 2022 International Teacher Tour with either Hazel Blomkamp or Jane Nicholas. This is an incredible opportunity to have an event with two of the top needle artists in the world, but you have to act quickly if your organization is interested. Also, you're encouraged to join the EGA today, either through a local guild or as a member at large. All the information is available at egausa.org. Thanks to the folks at Stitchville and EGA for sponsoring this week's show. And now, on to our conversation with Danielle Clough. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artist this week from South Africa, Danielle Clough. Danielle, welcome.
Hi, Gary. Thank you so much for having me. This is so wonderful.
Yes. Been trying and looking to do this for some time now. You've been on my list. It was the tennis rackets, but as I did the research, it became clear you'll embroider on just about anything.
No, anything I can kind of, anything I can get my hands on that's got enough holes in it for me to work with.
holy smokes. Is there anything you haven't tried? I mean, it's just amazing.
Oh, I've got a whole list of things that I'm like, you just kind of walk around, or I go to scrapyards or secondhand stores and I'm like, I'm sure I could put something on that. Oh, that needs a bird,
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you have to be the only needleworker who is known by name and face at a junkyard. I have to believe that.
I know. Yeah, it's quite something when you're trying to explain to somebody what you're looking for. You're like, I'm looking for a piece of mesh, something ideally flat-ish to sew on. They're like, to what? Do you know embroidery? And they're like, no, I don't. I don't know what you're talking about.
We crush cars here.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. So is that something? What, just occasionally you just go to the junkyard and just see what you can pick up?
Yeah, every now and then if I'm feeling a little like uninspired I kind of tend to jump around from different surfaces and different kind of like subject matter. So if I'm doing a portrait on fabric, I'm like, I never want to do another portrait on fabric again. I'm like, do you know what would be great is a flour on something, on metal, you know, and then I'll like zip down to the scrapyard and see what I can find. And then it kind of like sparks something in me. And sometimes I just keep the metal, you know, you always end up finding things. Like I found the front of a fan, like the front grid of a fan, and it's like beautiful and round. So it kind of looks like an embroidery hoop, and, you know, and then just being in that space kind of gets like the ideas going, and you gather it. And sometimes, you know, I don't necessarily get working immediately, but I do find that if I kind of take myself on these creative dates, then I do end up like replenishing the well of ideas. So yeah, zip down to the scrapyard.
Now, please tell me your backyard isn't just a pile of stuff you've hauled home. Please tell me that.
No. Unfortunately, I used to be such a hoarder, and I've managed to kind of like get rid of that trait. So now, yeah, I have three pieces of metal. I'm trying to discipline myself. I'm like, no more. And until you use this, and then it motivates you to actually do the project. So, you know,
yeah.
You tend to hoard like fabric and stuff because everything has so much potential, and then you don't really do anything. And then you just keep kind of building the, you know, you build your craft supplies, but don't actually put anything out there. So it's a way of like kind of getting myself to be productive and not just be a collector.
Yes, the ongoing problem of massive stash and zero finished projects. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I think, yeah.
So these, I love that inspiration from a junkyard. I can't get past that. But the first time I saw you, your work was the tennis rackets. Was that really, was that at the beginning of what you started to do? Or, you know, had you been embroidering for some time? How did they play in? Because that to me is, you know, it's a unique contrast of sports and then delicate embroidery, but it works so well. And when you mentioned about the fan cover, you know, the fan cover like a hoop, you know, well, there's your tennis rackets, the old ones, like a hoop. And,
yeah, exactly. So I kind of, I mean, I've said this a few times, but it's always, you know, people are like, why did you choose embroidery? And I always think like, oh, I never really chose it. I kind of accidentally stumbled upon it. And I just thought I had invented it because I was drawing with thread. You know, that's kind of how I saw it. And I started like just continuing in that idea of like drawing with thread. And then so it was kind of this hobby that I had on the side, but I knew that I loved it and I knew that it had all this potential. So it was never this thing that I was doing, and I didn't really have teeth, you know, it was just this project, kind of this secondary thing.
Yeah.
And then I would just put things on Facebook, and, you know, I was like, oh, I was playing around and I did this today, and I just, oh, and I did this. And then my friend once sent me, it was kind of like just a heart that was woven into the grid of the racket. So it kind of looked like a pixelated racket. And I was like, I don't know, I think I kind of felt challenged by that. I was like, all right, I can do that, but better. And then, you know, because I was such a hoarder, and I love going to like vintage markets and secondhand stores and stuff. And there's this place called Millerton Market in Cape Town, which is like a car boot sale that happens every Sunday. So, you know, Sunday came around and I went down and I found a couple secondhand like old tennis rackets and kind of started, you know, playing with that. And then, yeah, just I was always just it was just kind of one of the many things I was kind of half doing between my, you know, with it, like those half projects, you know, while I had all these jobs that I was doing at the time. And then, yeah, I put it online and somebody was like, oh, can I buy that? And I was like, really? Are you sure? And then I was like, okay. And then I put another one online and somebody else was like, well, can I buy that? And I was like, oh, maybe this is actually a thing. And then I kind of kept doing it, and then it got picked up online. And so it was the thing that really opened up the gates. I think exactly like you say, that contrast between it being like hard and sport and then the soft, delicate embroidery and the colors and everything, the novelty of it. And graphically, I think it works. And then that kind of just started. Then that got picked up by This Is Colossal and kind of went viral, as they say. And yeah, then the rest is history. And then I became a full-time embroiderer from the racket. So that's kind of how the trajectory of it was, where it wasn't it was like the start of the career, but it was it was just kind of the secondary thing that I was just playing around with.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I picked up is because you describe yourself as an accidental professional, and your career path, most people have a pretty linear career path, but yours is just very random and as I'm reading it, reading through and learning about it, there's more learning from mistakes than there is setting forth a path and following it strictly. You really have done a lot of trial and error. It's fun to learn about and to get to where you're at now. I mean, it's not for lack of trying all kinds of things.
Yeah, I've always believed that the best path to discovery is kind of the most organic one, which is usually through the process and the action of just doing, right? And it's within doing that you learn. It's within the process that you make mistakes, and it's through mistakes that you figure out what works, what doesn't work. I mean, I always kind of feel like my career path, I dropped out of school, I dropped out of mainstream school, and I ended up doing this alternative matric. I think our matric is like, let's say, I'm not 100% sure what that is, the equivalent of that is in the US, but it's kind of finishing school. And it was always through, I always kind of thought about it as a process of elimination, and it's going to be through the elimination that I'm going to figure out what I want to do. And I think that's probably, you know, we also have this idea that you're going to know what you want to do for the rest of your life when you're what, like 14, you know, you're 14 and then you start choosing your subjects. And I mean, when I was 14, I, you know, you can barely cook for yourself. How are you supposed to know what you're going to do for the rest of your life? So I think that was, I was always given like a lot of space to explore and to try things from a young age. And then through the trying and failing and trying and succeeding, you know, you start to figure out quite naturally what works for you and how your brain works. I think all of us, our brains work really differently, you know, so we have to kind of figure it out. And I think that's the freedom, giving yourself the freedom to not know, is probably one of the best ways to build an authentic, organic career and life for yourself. So I feel very grateful that I was given that space to play and learn. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's something we've talked about on several shows, is that ability and willingness to play, and how as we grow older, we lose that through peer pressure and societal pressures and so on and so forth. And that ability that we have as kids to just try stuff, just to see what if. And and you've carried that through all the way. And I guess I would applaud your parents, who have clearly been supportive of all your little paths. That speaks highly of them to say, hey, let her try, let her go. Yeah,
completely. I mean, especially in hindsight, you know, I'm very grateful, because I even remember my mom saying, I think I came home with like a terrible haircut and saying something. And this is kind of how, like, sums up how she took all my like life decisions. She goes, I don't understand it, but I like it. I get, but you know, but it suits you, that kind of thing. It's interesting, but as long as you're having fun, you know, and that kind of thing, and that giving you the, like, almost a non-judgmental room to learn and to do and to play and to explore. And then as long as you, within like certain parameters, like, you know, I had to always be responsible for myself and pay my rent and pay my way and all of that. So there's always, you still have to like live within society and live within the parameters of, a normal person. But then with the kind of without the judgment, and I think we put a lot of judgment on ourselves, and especially of like what it is to be an adult. And I remember reading somewhere when I was really young that like the ability to play and to explore is like an imagination, is like a superpower. And like kids have this, kids have these superpowers. And we see it when they're in a playground and they're able to like make, you know, a box into a castle for a queen with a dragon, you know, that really is a superpower. And we have to actually really work at protecting that and holding that and harnessing it. And I think especially today we have so many distractions, and these distractions are purposefully put into our lives and into our world, you know, so whether that's social media distractions or, you know, chasing kind of ideas of what it is to be successful, and whether that those ideas don't necessarily actually pertain to what we really want as success. All of these things really pull you away from just being like quite pure and in that process of play and imagination.
Yeah. How have you hung on to that? Because you play and you try, but there's also clearly a thread of determination to get to some unknown point B, at which it looks like you found that point B, but it's there's playing and trying and just meandering and at some point just idly wasting away time. But it seems like there's yeah. there's always been that drive in you to get to a point B.
Well, I think that's the responsibility as well. You know, that idea that you can play, but you still have to live within the world, you know, so you can say, like, I'm able to paint and to do whatever it is that you're playing with, but you still have to stick to your responsibilities, whatever that is. So if you aren't able to make money from your craft, for example, I used to work as a designer, and I knew that I didn't love it. Like, the work was just really, really, like, crushed me. It was like office work, and it was really quite mundane. And I knew at that time what it was to do something that I loved, and I knew that I didn't love it. So instead of just quitting and being like, oh, well, I'll figure it out, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to go and waitress, because waitressing is going to be the thing that's going to afford me the time to do the thing that I love.
Okay.
And if that means I have to waitress forever, then that's fine. But as long as I'm able to do the thing that I love. So that was kind of the way of saying, I need to protect what it is to be creative and to make and to, you know, from a honest and real place. And then I'm going to have to find a way to live within the world and do that. Not always, you know, I actually never really thought that I was going to be able to be an artist for a living. I always kind of thought, this is a thing that I love. I'm going to have to find a way to be able to do it. And that was, you know, anything, waitressing, hostessing, being a promotional girl. It was like, you know, and then I, you know, it started all these weird creative endeavors from like, I was a VJ for ages and, you know, take photographs at events and absolutely anything that would pay the bills so that I could do what I loved, you know?
Okay.
Don't know if that makes
yep.
sense.
No, I see that. Yeah, whatever allows you to feed yourself and have a roof, but gives you that freedom and that time. Yeah, that's
exactly.
That's good. So you started out, you wanted to be in the fashion industry. You're not the first one I've talked to who was in the fashion industry and got out. Was it just not a fit for you, or did you get there and discover it wasn't what you had in your head?
Yeah, it was. I left school and I did this alternative matric in visual arts, and it was a 2-year course, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was ridiculous. We did like potato prints, and it was really like rudimentary, really like not real life stuff. But yeah. I loved it. And I knew what it was. That was really the time that I was like, oh, this is what it is to love what you do. Yeah. And I was young. So, but by the time I went to fashion school, I was there and I was like, I don't love this. I just don't feel good here. And I was like, I know what it is to love what I do. And I just need to find out how I can, you know, what that looks like. And that was what kind of started the process of elimination, kind of way of living. I said, okay, so now I know what it is to love what I do, and now I know that fashion design isn't that thing. So where to from here, you know? And then I went and I did a whole bunch of internships. I did an internship at a magazine so I could work with photographers and stylists and in different departments so that I could continuously like eliminate what I didn't love so that I could really get to the core of what I did love. And yeah, fashion was, it was great, but I just found it a little bit technical, I think, at that time. And I really enjoyed the history of fashion, but I don't know, there was just something, it just didn't connect. And I wish I knew why, but I don't.
Well, kudos for realizing and finding somewhere else to go, because you know, how many people have a job that doesn't click with them, but they hang in there just because it's a paycheck. So
I know. I remember I drove home and I was driving on the highway and I was crying because I just didn't want to do it. And I got home and I said to my mom, I was like, Mom, I don't want to do this. And she was like, well, if you want to leave, leave now so we can get our money back. You know,
there, we go.
There we go.
Yep.
Support, but within the framework of you have to live yep. in the world, you know.
I'm on it, Mom. I'm quitting.
I'm going to quit really well. I know I always joke that I'm a massive fan of quitting. I am a huge quitter. I think it's okay to quit. It's not okay to stop working, but it's okay to quit.
Well, but that's a good point, because even in needlework, there are points with a project where you just say, no, this has to stop, and I got to move on to something else because this is just sucking the life out of me. And
100%.
Yeah, it takes the fun out of it. Yep. You got to find that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find that's also part of protecting what I do is making sure I only take on projects that I know I'm going to love the process of, because especially with needlework, it's such a time consuming
yes.
discipline to take on something that you're like, I'm not too sure if I'm going to enjoy this, but oh, the money's good, or I feel really bad, the person was so sweet, you know, and I really want to help them, but I know if my heart isn't in it, firstly, I'm going to disappoint them, and I'm going to be halfway through, and I'm just going to never want to do it again. and you can really burn yourself out of loving this incredible medium, because it does really demand so much of you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the tough part, because you do commission work. So finding that line where you say, nope, not this one. I used to do wedding photography. I did it for 10 years, and then I said one day, no more. The lady that who owned the business that I shot for. We were having a conversation one day, and this was back in the days when they built albums. You know, they took actual prints and built albums. And she commented one day. She said, "You know, there are just some weddings that you're money ahead if you say no." And that stuck with me all through the years, because there truly were, and I think that applies to really any creative process. And you just described where sometimes it's just better to say no, because you're not going to be into it. You're not going to be enthusiastic. And if in the end, you're not going to do your best work. And so it's best to just get out in the beginning. Yeah.
And it's the most fair thing that you can do for the other person as well, for the person on the other side of that commission or of that project, because if you know at some point your heart's not going to be in it, that's not the right thing to do to somebody else whose whole heart is in it, or they have expectations of what they need you to do and the investment they need you to have in it. So, and I think, you know, especially when it comes to creativity, to give something that you're not invested in and hand it over to someone, I mean, I personally feel, I don't know if it's like the hippie in me, but I think that they can feel it and they can sense it. And, you know, even online, when you're not really sure about something and you put it online, you'll always find like it just doesn't feel the same, you know, and it doesn't get the same response as you'd imagine it would get, you know, because you think maybe you're playing to your audience. But if your heart's not in it, it's so palpable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just work. So you must have at that moment, at that moment of the exchange, either the ideas start flowing right away and your heart beats faster, or you're just sitting there going, yeah, I can do this, but I really don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not always because of what the work is. It's often, you know, I'm not in the space for it. You know, like I say, like, oh, I can't do another portrait, or like if I do one more flower on a tennis racket, I'm, you know, I'm quitting. So you do tend to go, you just have to kind of, I think a lot of what we do is about intuition. So I feel like you do tend to, you need to be connected to your intuition, because that is really where a lot of like your ideas and your innate feelings of the success of a piece or a project or a relationship is within that intuition.
Yeah. When you must have been many cases, situations where you were starting to get into a rut. Like you said, one more flower on a tennis racket, spare me. But what do you do to get out of that? You just go do something completely different, go to the junkyard?
Yeah. I'm trying to say, I have ruts for different reasons. So I think a big part of it is to try and figure out, like, what am I stuck on? Am I stuck on the fact that, you know, I'm doing something and maybe I've committed to doing too many and I feel like I just can't do the same thing again? I do tend to like to jump around between different projects, and kind of like I was saying earlier, you want to build your world around the way your brain works. And I'm diagnosed like low grade ADD, which makes perfect sense, because I cannot do any admin tasks. I'm jumping around. My hands have to be busy. When I'm in front of the TV, I want to sew or draw or do something. But if I'm doing something I love, like sewing, I won't move. So it's kind of like I've got these stereotypical ways that my brain works, and now I've built my life around my brain. And so I think what it is for me is trying to figure out why I'm in that rut, what is my brain saying? What does it need? And to break out of it. So one of the things that I'll do, like, for example, if I've done too many of the same thing, then I'll go, okay, I need to go and work on a completely different surface. So if it's been about, I've been working on a bunch of rackets, then I'm like, okay, I need to do something like on a beautiful soft fabric. And it needs to be highly detailed. And I'd want to, I'll do like a portrait, or I'll sit and I'll watch a movie and I'll be like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to get this Wes Anderson, like capture this kind, you know. So it's kind of trying to find things that inspire me, but that is the opposite of what I've done. That's put me in that like feeling of sameness and that rut. So I think it's hard to kind of tell people what would help them if they're in a rut, because I think it's so personal, the things that we get stuck on and stuck in. So I think, again, it's like connecting to that intuition, really taking time to listen to yourself and be like, what's putting me in this discomfort, and then clambering your way out of it in whatever way you need to.
Yeah, but you say it's hard to tell people, but you just told them, do something. If you know, if you're feeling like you're stuck, do something. Don't just ride it out. Yeah. I mean, that's, it doesn't matter what it is. Just go try something. Yes, go play.
Exactly. Yeah. And also break your patterns. You know, I think sometimes we think, okay, no, I have to work every day to get all this work done, and we're it can make us feel really stuck, you know. So you go, okay, well then break the pattern, go work in a coffee shop and talk to somebody. If you're doing needlepoint in a coffee shop, somebody will talk to you, and it will make you feel so confident, you know, because you realize how special your medium is.
Right.
Or if you're always out and you're in a studio, like, just don't work for the day and take it home in the evening. And like, really, I think finding ways to break the pattern that you have that's got you stuck. Like, I find now I'm in a bit of a negative feedback loop because of social media. So I'm like, I have to be responsible for this feeling that I have. I'm the only person who can guard my time and my attention. I'm the guardian of my productivity. And I have to break this thing. So, you know, going offline and finding ways to kind of refuel that fire. But it's difficult because it is a process, and it's so personal, and our work feels so personal. So to, you know, yeah, it's really finding your own way of what's got you stuck there, and then, you know, breaking that.
Yeah.
But you have to actively try break it.
Yeah, well, that's it. Active. You have to be active about it. You can't just hope it'll happen to you. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you can quit, but you can't stop working.
Right, right. Where does the art come from? Is the art a natural thing to you? Is it schooling? Because you clearly have, obviously you have needlework skills, but there's clearly an artist behind that.
I never thought I was creative. My family aren't very creative. They're very athletic and stuff. And I didn't really think of myself as being creative growing up. And then the other day I was moving house, and I found my box of old diaries, and every page is covered in glitter and sequins, and you know, and I've got all these things stuck on there, and every line is like a different color of pen. And I thought, oh, this is it. This is the beginning of like a creative mind, but just not really knowing. So I think I've always had a level of creativity to what I did, but it was only when I actually went to, I wanted to be a fashion designer. I never thought of that as a creative thing. My mom used to sew, so I always thought fabric was always the thing that felt like really comfortable. But because I didn't come from a creative family, it just felt like a career choice, a very practical career choice. So then, but to get an advantage at fashion design school, which is why I went to that visual arts school when I dropped out of mainstream school. And then, yeah, so I think it kind of, and then that like opened up the door of creativity, but I still never saw it as like a form of art. I just always saw it as this like really fun thing to do that would get me to this ultimate career of doing fashion or graphic design. I studied advertising, so I always saw it as being quite conventional and commercial. I've always like moved in a commercial kind of stream of creativity.
You use a lot of photography. You obviously have skills in other art areas. Two things that come to my mind there is why not be a photographer? Because there seems to be a real connection with photography. And then how is it that needle and thread become the medium through which you express your art as opposed to, you know, paintings or drawings or whatever?
Well, photography actually was a big focus of mine when I was studying at advertising school. So I was self-taught. I got like an old film camera again, you know, secondhand stores. I'm like, oh, this is cool. And then started teaching myself photography. And then I used it in my projects and would take photos of friends and friends that were in bands and started taking photographs, you know, for fashion labels and stuff like that. And kind of slowly built up an amateur photography career while I was studying. And then when I finished studying, I had a few jobs and I assisted a few photographers, but I wasn't, I think this is why I've harnessed this idea of protecting what you love, is because I didn't protect it. I didn't know how to. And I did a lot of jobs I didn't want to do. And that's why I said that's why I gasped when you said you were a wedding photographer, because I did one wedding and I completely botched it up. It was a nightmare. I mean, I still sweat when I think about what happened. But I do love the photography aspect of creativity. And again, I never thought of it as a photography as a creative career. I thought of it as quite a practical career. I thought, you know, it's quite a commercial avenue of creativity. And then, you know, I didn't really protect the photography, so it ended up becoming more of a personal thing. And I have I've got a blog online where I would upload all my film photos. But the photography and playing with film and the colors of cross-processing film and lighting is actually really what informed my embroidery. Because it's taken me a while to kind of see the connection, but I like working from my own reference photos, and it's the photography and playing with lights and playing with studio lights. That's what really learned, it's where I've learned the most about like shapes and contrast and highlights, and you know that all the stuff that really builds a good image and composition, and then that lends itself to how I like built up my embroidery career and my embroidery kind of technique, which is also very much based on like form, contrast, and color.
Okay, I can see that working. Here, I'm gonna help you when you start sweating about the one wedding photography thing. All right, here's my horror story. All right, it's a Friday night. It's a Friday night. A small wedding, like really small, close family and friends, Valentine night, I mean the 14th of February.
Oh, and, okay.
All right, and I'm going to shoot this thing. I shot exactly two rolls of film. Okay, it was that.
It was film.
It was film, ooh. Yeah. Two rolls of film, 36 shots each. It was that small of a wedding, like bang, bang, we're out of here, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The main roll with all the things, with the portraits of the bride and groom and everything like that, the film did not get hooked onto the take-up spindle.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, and so the wedding is over. They're on their way out the door, and I'm rewinding the film. And the minute you start, you know it never hooked. So
yes.
I took all those pictures and nothing. And and so the lady I worked for, she had to, I mean, there was nothing we could do. It was, I couldn't call them back. They were half gone. And so she had to get family and friends photos to build an album. Yeah. So when you start sweating about that one of yours, just think about that. Yeah, I come back with nothing.
Mine is pretty close to that. The wedding was a last minute wedding because the bride's father was very ill and old, and so they really just wanted to get this wedding, and they booked me last minute, and I didn't format the cards properly, and I shot the wedding and did all the family photos, and on the card with the family photos and the grandfather or the father of the bride and everything, I formatted it afterwards, and they were gone.
Oh.
Everything. So it's the same thing. And I had half the wedding photos, and the ones that they needed weren't there. And you know, how do you send that email of being like, here are the photos I do have, and everything else is in the ether, and I'm really sorry.
Oh. Yeah, that'll make me sweat. That's making me sweat right now. Yep.
I know. And you just know it was just so devastating, you know. And I just think the one reason you have this day is to, you know, document it and to have the special. But whatever. I mean, you make mistakes. You make mistakes, and then you think, you know what? I'm going to hang up my camera right now and maybe pick up a needle.
Yep.
It definitely helped me change my career trajectory. So
yeah, that'll make you run away from wedding photography. Yep. Yeah.
It's like, what can I do in this house? What's around me? A needle, a thread, and a piece of fabric. Yeah. Cool. Make it work.
I love the story. Tell the story of when you discovered needle painting. I just love that. You discovered
it's so
it right here.
I discovered it. I invented embroidery. So I was working at the time. I was studying and I dropped out of fashion design, you know, a big quitter. And I had started studying art direction and graphic design. And the school was above a fabric store. So as a way of like making extra beer and pizza money, I would say to like my fellow students, like, why don't you draw a monster and I'll turn it into a plush toy and we'll go buy the fabric together. So they're like, okay, awesome. And then they would draw these little monsters and we'd go down to the fabric store, we'd choose a fabric and, you know, and so I always had like a needle and thread on me and some scrap fabric and it was always in my bag. So on my weekend job, I was working at a gallery. And the gallery owner gave me this laptop. So he said, here you go, you know, go find some people who are, you know, go look for customers. And I sat in this gallery for about 40 minutes trying to open this laptop. I was sliding these little clippies. They weren't working. I was trying to flip things and all the rest. And he came down and I just thought, he can't see me. I can't even open the laptop. I mean, how inefficient is that for a gallery, you know, assistant? So I just kind of like was sitting there and pretended to be busy. And the only thing I had in my bag was like was a scrap piece of felt and a needle and thread, you know, for these plush toys. And so I kind of like sat there and I was like, oh, sorry, I'm just busy, you know, being creative or whatever. And I started drawing and I drew this like bunny on a piece of with the needle and thread. And I was like, I cannot believe this. I have just invented a new medium. It's called thread sketching. I'm taking over the world. I am a genius. Anyway, so it didn't take long for me to realize that the laptop was the wrong way around and I just needed to open it. I was trying to unclip the hinges. I was like playing with the hinges of a Mac. Oh, it was terrible. And then obviously that my thread sketching invention was actually embroidery and had been around since the beginning of time.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But for a
Not
moment
the
there, for a brief moment yeah. there, you created a whole new world, yes.
A whole new world. I mean, much to the dismay of my ego, I realized. I was like, I'm not the first. But anyway, I mean, it was great. And then, I mean, what it did end up doing was opened up this floodgate. So I was like, oh, wait, I'm not the first. Oh, and look at all these colors. And look at this thread. And, oh, what if I tried this? You know, it was, you, right. There's all these tools, you know, a hoop. I mean, when I discovered a hoop, I was like, this is incredible.
But that was funny as that is still a very, very much a turning point for you then.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And again, it was like, oh, this is incredible. I love this. I had that deep feeling of like, I absolutely love this. And how am I going to make this work? How am I going to make this my life?
Yeah. Now you mentioned about the portraits and I have to say, The tennis rackets are unique in their own little world, but the portraits, what you're able to do with this technique that you invented, this thread sketching, that you brilliantly came up with, the portraits they really come through, you know, and this is I always struggle with this, you know, you say they come through, they're just like a painting, you know. Well, no, they really are painting. It's just thread instead of oil. But
yeah.
A lot of work to develop that technique because you really have a nice touch for putting depth and highlights and dimension to it. And so the photography comes in and it all starts to gel within these portraits then.
Yeah, I love the portraiture. I'm actually busy working on one now. I'm building a class. I'm working with Skillshare, and we're building another class, and I'm actually going to teach portraiture, which is quite nerve-wracking for me because, you know, it's like the thing to hand kind of everything over is always a little bit like discomforting in a way, but it's but also really exciting. And it's been quite an interesting process because I have to dissect what I do and why, which is quite unnatural because, you know, you normally just like figure out this thing over time and, you know, you don't really realize why you do something. Yeah. And then to have to kind of put it into words has been a really interesting process. But yeah, I love how natural things are when it comes to portraiture. You know, like there's the direction of the stitches, which I think is probably what makes it look like painting, is the directionality. You know, like if you look at Van Gogh's work, how he uses direction in his paint, and it's the same with the stitches, and how natural that is. Because I was trying to think, you know, what made me choose these directions, and what, how do I explain this? And I was like, if you think about wrinkles, it's the same thing. You know, wrinkles move up along the eyes and down depending on your, you know, with your smile lines and around your mouth, and those are things that we like pick up unconsciously when we just by living. You know, when you notice, you're like somebody, things are disproportionate. You know, if eyes are too far apart or too close together, because we have this natural visual language that all of us have developed over time just by being in the world. And I think that's what I love so much about the portraiture, is that it's actually this, it's kind of like reimagining all that, or taking all that information that you've picked up since, you know, you opened your eyes, and then placing it down. And I'm really enjoying the process of finding how to explain that to people.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it. When you have to explain what your art is, that's like asking a baseball player to describe how he hits a baseball. And so many of them simply can't do it because they just do it. Yeah. And to lay out step by step, like, you got to be kidding me. And then they start thinking too much about it and it messes them up. And so to put together a class like that has got to be a real mental challenge.
It is. It's a huge challenge, but it's also so amazing because you don't, it validates that what I was saying about making mistakes and the process, because all the things that you've learned, you start going, oh, and I learned this here, and I can see where I started changing this technique, or I picked this up because when I did it there, it didn't work out. So you start going, oh, this is why I do this stuff, and that's where it came from. And it really, like, when I've said this before, you know, you can't connect the dots unless you're making the dots. So it's really nice to kind of look back and go, oh, yes, I was making a dot there and there and there, and that's how all of these things kind of piece together. And then to, you know, break it apart and hand it over is quite an – yeah, it's a very interesting process, but it's difficult. It's really challenging.
Now, this is your second class with Skillshare?
Yeah, my second formal class. I've done two live classes with them, one on color and one on embroidery on clothes. But this is going to be an intermediate class, which is a follow-up on the beginner's embroidery class.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit nervous about it, but it'll be fun.
Any idea when this goes live?
On Valentine's Day.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
There we go.
All right.
Full circle. Hopefully this will be a good Valentine's Day.
Way to tie it in.
Hopefully
nice job.
Delete the files.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Hopefully they
load
the full.
I know. That's awful. Oh. Yeah. So now you've done some portraits of some pretty famous people. I'm a David Letterman fan. Always have been. Still miss him in the evening. But that one of him is, well, you talk about capturing the guy. You really did. What is that like to work for people at that level of fame, fortune, whatever it might be? I assume that most of them are just incredibly kind individuals.
Well, I've done work for Drew Barrymore, and I've done work for David Letterman, and then Gucci and Adobe and a few big brands, but I've never worked directly with, I have for a few kind of celebrity. I've never, ever had a bad experience.
Yeah.
Never with an individual. And the David Letterman piece, I worked with an agency for that. And I mean, I was just this, I think the my point of contact was a guy called Anthony, and he's wonderful. I mean, I haven't spoken to him in 2 years since the project wrapped up, and I still think about like how lovely it was to work for him. I don't know if it's in embroidery or needlework in general, but when people come to, I've found so far, when people come to this medium and they want something from it, whether it's a commission or, you know, if they're in a workshop space, everybody is so open and kind. I don't know if it's because it's not as competitive or it's hard to be competitive with needlework because it's so time consuming. And it's quite ridiculous to think of us all like fighting against each other with like a needle and like, a, you know, a piece of linen. But I've found that it's just so open and people are so generous and gentle and kind. So I've had one or two negative experiences with agencies, but for the most part, you know, I mean, that's a, is a blip in the ocean of amazingness. But I do tend to be a little bit more nervous with the high profile work, especially if it's going to go onto like a big platform. But you know, once you start, it's also again the beauty of our medium. It's like once you start working, you become so present in what you're doing that you forget who it's for. You're sitting there and it's just you and the fabric and that beautiful like popping and sound that the thread makes when it goes through the fabric. Yeah. And you know, and everybody, the noise kind of tends to soften. And then only when you hand it over, the nerves kind of come back. You're like, I hope you like this. I really hope you like this. And you kind of like, because if you don't, there's not much I can do about it either.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, that's why I wanted to go down this path, because I wondered if you felt an extra pressure to do extra good stitching while you're doing it, and you don't. You just get lost in the project and the creativity.
Completely.
And just let it happen. Okay.
Completely. And, you know, again, I don't take commissions with the same idea of protecting what you do and why you do it. I don't take on commissions. Or I don't take on work that I'm not going to be excited about. So whether it's for a friend down the road and it's, I find it challenging and exciting, or it's for, you know, Netflix or whatever, it's as long as if I'm emotionally invested in the piece, it's pretty much the same across the board. And then as soon as I'm working, it's just me and the work.
Yeah. That's great that you're able to compartmentalize that and just set all the other stuff aside and just be creative while you're working on it. Because many people will be a bundle of nerves as they're working away. Yeah. And it would show.
It does show. And also, you know, I think you have to, I've definitely made an effort to resign myself to the fact that like, I'm only going to be able to do my best. And my best is going to be different from day to day. And my best today is going to probably be terrible in 4 years' time. If I look back at what I did before, and I remember I've sold a piece and I saw it the other day on my website and I deleted it off my website. And I was like, how do I find the person who bought this and apologize? You know,
oh my.
I just so terrible because I'm like, it's so far from what I'm capable of doing now. So kind of like I try to give myself the forgiveness that I need to give my, like past me for, you know, the future me is going to need to give current me, if that makes sense. So
yeah.
Going like, this is only going to be today's best. And that's all I can do. That's all I can do is whatever today's best is.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is you can't be brilliant right out of the gate. It's an ongoing progression. And I'm sure that 5 years from now, you'll look back at what you're doing today and go, wow, I'm a lot better than that.
Send out bulk apologies. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I'm better now, you know, and you think, oh, well, only thing I can do is hopefully be an investment. If I get better, then, you know, the work goes up in value and hopefully I'm an investment. It's a hard thing to resign yourself to, but you know, if you, again, about the work is that you have to be doing the work to get better. I think people expect to have these huge platforms and huge audiences and to be really good. And if they're frustrated, they get so frustrated. I teach as well, you know, I do workshops and see people being so frustrated with themselves for not getting it. And you know, you've got to start somewhere and you only get it by doing it. And then again, making those dots so that you can connect them and that you can move forward. But it's really hard to do in the moment when you're disappointed in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you wonder how many canvases were thrown in Van Gogh's backyard because he just didn't work. Finally, there was so much paint on the canvas he couldn't use it anymore. Even the backyard, try something else. You know,
exactly.
Everybody has to go through that.
We don't throw anything in the backyard anymore. We feel like, I can't speak for everyone else, but I feel like we create and we put outputs and we output to an audience. And we always feel like everything we make has to be successful and then validated by this kind of social media audience. Where before, artists would work in a studio and they'd make 20 paintings and they would play and they would test things and it would be super frustrating. It would be a struggling artist and maybe one of those paintings would be brilliant in a series. And then they'd say, okay, this is definitely a thing, you know, go for this, try to do more of this. But we expect everything we do to be good and then to be put out and then to be validated. And I think that like that constant hunger, I know I'm speaking for myself, that constant kind of need for validation is actually really destructive because you're not just creating for the sake of creating and process and learning and building and growing because you just want to be there at that level with such high expectations of making it, you know?
Thank you. Because that is, to me, is one of the fundamental problems with social media. Is that very thing, is that people just tend to develop this need to just be applauded and validated. And to do that, you must put out perfection in your mind at all times. And I think it sucks the learning out of it.
100%. And it's also very, it puts you into a feedback loop with an audience as opposed to a feedback loop with yourself.
Yes.
How do I feel about this? Do I like this? Did you enjoy the process? And you start writing the audience into your work. And it's an imaginary audience. It's not a person who comes into your studio and goes, oh, wow, I love that. It's a double tap. And you think, oh, I only got 50 likes on this and I should have got, and it only reached 1,000 people and I could, you know, da, 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 and you're crunching all these numbers. I know this is, you know, 100% something that I've done. You're crunching all these numbers and all of it is so, it's really destructive. It's really, really destructive to the process of, and that validation is so, it's so intangible. And I think, and it's not you, it's not your voice. It's not your style. It's not your technique. It's not your growing and learning. So yeah, I'm finding it very challenging at the moment to separate myself from the beast that feeds my, my career and then myself that actually is my career, you know, and does the creating that makes the thing, that makes all the pieces move.
Yeah, that's exactly the trouble is you need social media, not just you particular, but so many artists need social media to get the word out and to be known and to be seen. Yet now you're relying on audience, many of whom who have no clue about what you do or what's involved to validate that work. And it really is a difficult situation to be in. Yes.
Yeah. And it's like a blessing and a curse. Like you say, your audience, I mean, I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for Instagram. I am so grateful for the platform, the people that I've met through it, the things I've been able to do because of it. Like I think it's absolutely changed my life. And I'm endlessly grateful to have been born in a time where Instagram is around, but I'm also equally like sad about the fact that it consumes so much of my emotional time, my mental time, my creative time. But again, you know, I'm responsible for that, so I have got to monitor that, and I've got to find ways around it, you know. But it's a blessing and a curse, you know. It's like, and I guess everything is always double sided, you know.
Right. Yeah. I was most fascinated in all of your work, and I say Adidas, and I know in the other parts of the world it's said differently, but that shoe that you made for the athletic shoe store that you decorated, you went all in. You just didn't embroider something on the side and call it good. I mean, the sole, the beads around the sole, everything must have been you had fun. I could tell.
Oh, I had so much fun with that piece. I got I had such an amazing client. He just said, I remember I asked him, I was like, hey, Ashley, what do you think if I did this and this? And he goes, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I asked you to do it because you're you. So go and do what you want. And I was like, freedom. And and I promised myself I wouldn't get anything from outside of my house. Everything had to be, because the whole thing was about reimagining a sustainable future. And I thought part of that reimagining is creating with your imagination and finding ways of like using the things around you and repurposing or reusing it and giving things, you know, really, really like thinking about things that you already have as opposed to consuming. So yeah, everything, you know, I have all these secondhand beads. I always go buy beads at the markets and stuff like that and put those into the shoe with dressmakers pins. And I used an old wood bag. I think it used to be a rice bag for the tongue. And I just had the best time with that project. It was up till 3 a.m. beating that sole. And
can't put it down. Can't so put it fun. Down. Yeah.
No,
it's just, you can just tell the pictures of you putting it together, but also the finished project, that your mind just went crazy. You just had a great time putting it together. Yeah.
I know. I handed it over to him and I was just like, okay, I hope you like this. Like, I kind of went a little bit crazy, but
yeah,
it was really cool. I had a lot of fun.
Yep, it's fun. Now, help me understand your kits. Now, there's what two kits. The one that, the most recent one, Backyard Barbie. What what are those all about? I didn't get that.
Okay. Well, it's good to know you didn't get it. I maybe need to explain it a bit better. So it's just me.
Don't feel that. No.
So, you know, I've often been asked by people if I'm going to do kits and this and that. And I've mulled over it for a while and especially in lockdown, a lot of people were making kits and I thought, these are great. Like I really love and respect what everybody's doing, but I was like, I wanted to do something that kind of like a print where it's limited edition. And I wanted to do kits that were like of my favorite things. So not just what you need to get something done, but of like my favorite things to do it. Like if I had to get a box of just the ultimate little package of, you know, the prize, what would it look like? So I created the first one was called Acid Rain. And they're always limited edition. So like the prints, when they're sold, I never recreate it with the same combination of stuff. So the first one was Acid Rain, and then the second one is called Backyard Barbie. And Backyard Barbie is kind of like, I always imagine the colors of being like girly but bright, but also a little bit off. You know, like Barbie in the backyard smoking a cigarette. Maybe she's got a beer in her hand, you know, with her feet in the pool kind of thing. And I developed choose the fabrics around that. And I import scissors from Canada and I put in like local fabrics that all kind of work within the theme. I find beads and I get everything printed on RISO, which is this beautiful printing process. And I ended up making these like neon prints with glitter. It's just all very like everything is very extra, and I take a couple months to assemble them and to go through the whole process, and I do all the design and stuff, and then there are 30, I think the Backyard Barbie kit, there's 35 in the edition of kits, and then people buy them, and that combination of kit will never be made again. So it's just my own way of kind of like putting together all the things that I just love.
Yeah. Now, there's no specific project with these. It's just, here's some materials, do with them what you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
I considered putting together a project, but I think that what I really actually want is that the materials inspire people to create something with their own voice and their own technique and their own style, you know? So I just put in things that I know if I saw it in a shop, which is what happens, I see it and I'm like, oh, this green linen is insulting. It is so good and it is so obnoxious. I have to have it, you know? And I think, and everybody else who wants this, who feels the same, can have it too, you know? So that's kind of how I feel. And I hope other people who buy it, you know, get to open and unpack everything. And I get things made by, you know, needle keepers made by a friend of mine. And it's all kind of like, and she makes all my earrings I always wear, she's made. So I was like, please, Cynthia, please, can you make needle keepers, you know? So it's just to really kind of ignite that feeling of like, oh, this is delicious. I just want to be creative with it.
Okay. All right. I guess that's what I didn't get. I was looking for the project. And I should have been looking for, here are the tools to be creative. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Looking for the weird Barbie pattern.
Well, I was, because I thought, well, what's she going to do with Backyard Barbie? And then I didn't see a Barbie. And all right, now I get it. Okay, now it comes to me. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's such a fun project. I mean, it's just, again, I get to work with such cool suppliers, and I end up meeting such amazing people who hand-dye thread, you know, like in their backyard and, you know, in Durbanville. And you know, it's just such a cool way of connecting and putting something together. That's also very different to what I do. It's not so personal as well. It's not like when you're creating a project and I'm doing a portrait, it really feels really personal. And it's like a big reflection of me and my ability. And I'm really injected into that work, where the kits is very much like I get to put it into the world and see what gets made with them. And it's really nice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I get it now. Thank you. I feel better.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Danielle, this has been a real treat to talk to you. Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Yeah. Of course, Gary. Yeah, it's been so wonderful to connect.
Yep. All right. And DanielleClough.com, and it's C-L-O-U-G-H.
Yes. Yeah, Clough, like rough.
Yes.
Or tough.
And thanks so much. And February 14 is the next Skillshare class.
Yeah, so excited about it.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening.